What is in your heart?
A woman far away, he said, his eyes still closed, marveling at the feeling in his brain and at his answer, which just popped out of his mouth before he could think. Grace shifted closer to him, her arms around his neck.
Breathe with me, she said, inhaling deeply.
She put her mouth on his and started inhaling and exhaling into his mouth, surrounding him in hot velvet and electricity. Her breath controlled his breath. She rocked slightly and leaned forward so their expanding stomachs touched. Grace whispered into his lips.
Who else is in your heart? She said.
Nate thought of Agnes and Palos Verdes, and Hannah killed, and white-haired General Korchnoi murdered, and Gable gone, and Benford, Forsyth, and Burns, who were his colleagues and family, and the bucket-headed image of PLA General Tan, that profligate beetle whom Nate had just recruited, and he almost said his name out loud.
Shit. What is this?
Nate, struggling, blinked three times very quickly, and she knew she had lost him, at least for now. She moved back slowly, sliding off him. Dominica sat in the armchair, legs crossed, squeezing her thighs together, sweating. She had forced herself to sit still as she watched the monitor and imagined the feel of Nate's body pressed against Grace and Yab-Yum, and her lips tingled imagining those kisses. Thank God she didn't have to hide an orgasm, sitting a meter from the appalling rainy Shanghuan, who was watching the screen with his mouth open. She had panicked when Grace had dabbed Nate's neck with fragrant oil, but she realized this was not the assassination night. That last kiss. She was astounded by Grace's apparent skill in dragging Nate into a meditative state, something she knew she could never do. Strangely, she was not mad at him. Seeing him after all these months on a high-resolution screen was a shock, and she felt a million kilometers away. She knew he had not planned for this to happen, that he was working on the Chinese woman, and it was she who had initiated the contact. To be sure, Dominica would break a vase over his head when, if, she saw him next, but she realized she still loved him. He had said he loved a woman far away, which she knew meant her. She was the first person he thought about from his Yab-Yum-addled subconscious. Oh, how this espionage got in the way of their lives. But right now, jealousy, pique, longing, and horniness were superfluous. Dominica didn't know if Nate could resist the mind-warping blandishments of this gorgeous Chinese girl. But she knew that whether or not the MSS pried the name of Nate's agent out of him, they would very soon reach the point where they would give Zhen the order to eliminate him. He was a beetle in a matchbox, and they were going to step on him. Rainy Shanghuan watched the screen as Grace said goodnight to Nate at the front door to the apartment. He ordered the technicians to shut down the surveillance monitors and microphones and turned to Colonel Igorova.
You can see Zhen Yao is extensively trained and meticulously prepared, he said. She uses the mystical aspects of this yoga to manipulate her targets, to employ Tao Ku De Zufa, elicitation methods. If she succeeds, it will happen next time. If at the conclusion of the next contact the American does not reveal the name of the mole, the order to eliminate will be given.
You know your operation best, said Dominica, casually, wondering if there was a wet spot on the back of her skirt. But eliminating the American now seems premature. Your girl is making good progress. You could potentially learn additional secrets from this officer about CIA operations in China.
Rainey shrugged. Beijing insists, he said. She will invite him for another dinner in 2 days, and we will see what happens. Zhen Yao will stay in this apartment from tonight, in case the American becomes lonely and amorous, and decides to visit unannounced.
And how will you eliminate the target? Said Dominica.
Rainey Shanghuan showed a muddy riverbank smile.
Zhen Yao is an expert with firearms, edged weapons, the rope, and a variety of classical weapons. She is also expert in hand-to-hand combat. Her knowledge of poisons and toxins is encyclopedic, said Rainey. The requirement, as in most cases such as this, is to mask the hand of the service. She will choose the appropriate method.
It doesn't sound like she will have any trouble, answered Dominica, suddenly overwhelmed. The lingering terror waiting for her back in Moscow, if she were exposed by the mole in Washington, came back to her suddenly.
both she and Nate were teetering on the knife edge of ruin. Kisaw's Burmese Tomato Salad. Slice medium tomatoes into crescents, cut cherry tomatoes in half, and slice sweet onion into crescents and place in a bowl. Add toasted sesame seeds, crushed peanuts, dried shrimp powder, diced chilies, and chopped coriander. Deep-fry garlic and additional onions until crispy and add to bowl. Whisk lemongrass vinegar or substitute rice wine vinegar, canola oil, fish sauce, lime juice, and palm sugar, and pour over salad. Mix gently with hands and garnish with reserved fried garlic and onions and a chiffonade of cilantro. Goes well with rare steak. Chapter 30. Emptiness. Zhen disliked staying in the Honey Trap apartment. Her personal flat was in a smaller building in mid-levels, where she was surrounded by her books, yoga materials, and comfortable furniture. Staying in this nearly empty apartment was an inconvenience. It moreover meant the assassination phase was near, and although she had no compunction about eliminating a target, she was always depressed at the conclusion of an operation. She enjoyed the hunt, engineering first contact, coyly developing the relationship, the heady thrill of seduction, and the dizzying anticipation of the final act, up to the moment she eased a steel needle between the cervical vertebrae of the neck, or looped a silk rope around a throat, or watched a victim's eyes grow in alarm as the chest-constricting effects of a poison were first felt. But afterward, there was an emptiness, a depression, a melancholy. An emptiness that yoga helped relieve. Zhen always told herself that she worked as a poison-feather bird to feed her stomach, but she practiced yoga to feed her soul. Practice gave perspective, energy, and the strength to accept what she could not change. But there were some things she could indeed change. Her unhappy childhood and subsequent exploitation as a teenaged concubine, and the humiliating, scurvy years in Nightingale School and at the Institute in Beijing learning to kill increased her resolve never to let anyone mistreat her again. The first time had been in London at university, where she had been singled out as a shy exotic by a group of male students, the majority of whom were simply bullies, but one of them had wanted more. Zhen did not bring any of the usual weapons from the Institute with her to the United Kingdom, except for two Gong Fu Shan, pleated Kung Fu fighting fans, one black, one red, wide and delicate, with expanding wings of edged metal affixed to the fan folds. These were medieval martial arts weapons, and Zhen could make them flutter like birds' wings, snapping them open and closed with a report like a gunshot. There was a complicated social protocol as well in the use of fans, ancient Chinese conventions essentially lost on most Britons, but Zhen had studied them because they would be most relevant when she returned to the Orient as a seductress. Drawing a closed fan along a cheek meant, "I want you." Touching the edge of the extended fan lightly with the fingers meant, "I want to talk to you." To tap the lips with the closed fan meant, "Kiss me." None of these applied to the rangy British Romeo named Rowdy White, who pushed his way into Zhen's dormitory room one night and stood amused as she held two puny folded fans in front of her, ready to defend herself. Rowdy's cumulative experience with fans was limited to the big ostrich feather variants used by the dancers in the strip clubs off High Street. When Rowdy reached to grab Zhen by the arm, the black fan opened with a pop, deflecting his hand. Chuckling to himself, Rowdy again reached for her, and the red fan snapped open, blocked his other arm, then folded in the blink of an eye, and snapped down across his wrist. That hurt. He snarled, stepped forward, arms extended, and both fans snapped open with a clatter like pigeons taking flight in a park, and the leading edge of one fan was raked across his face an inch above his eyebrows, slicing his forehead and blinding him as blood streamed into his eyes and down his cheeks. It was Zhen Yao's first blood, and she was mildly surprised how easy it had been. She wasn't hungry, but she made a small pot of Shen Kai soup, simple lettuce soup, and let it cool on the stove. She opened the balcony door for the night breeze and sat naked on the big pillow on the floor in the dark and empty living room, inhaling great drafts of air, distending first her stomach, then her diaphragm, then her lungs, and expelling her breath in reverse order, pulling her navel in and up and locking her root chakra. She quietly repeated the Adi mantra, Om Namu Guru Dev Namu, bowing to the teacher within and continued breathing. She got to her feet and leaned forward into a deep lunge, her body glistening, breast straining, muscular arms above her head, then flowed into a series of poses, her breath steady and hissing on the exhale. But something was wrong. Her concentration was off tonight. She liked the young American and had to admit to herself that he was decent and charming. His comments about freedom and Hong Kong were obviously recruitment talking points, but she agreed with them. She wondered what he'd be like in bed. She did not sleep with men after Nightingale School, but she didn't much care whether he lived or died. She was alone in the world, not aligned with anyone, not with Beijing, not with the MSS, not with the hotel to which she devoted all her energies. She knew Nate was CIA and that he wanted to recruit her. She had used her professional wiles to encourage him, flirted with him and kissed him, all to maneuver him into the kill zone. Her recruitment was an impossibility, of course. She would never ally herself with the Americans, and besides, the MSS was observing everything. Jen had been told that she had to elicit or trick or fuck the name of a mole out of him, but if after two nights she was not successful, she was to assassinate him. It would happen tomorrow night. She would take a vial of monk's hood distillate mixed with fragrant ylang ylang oil, and using great care, a drop on her own skin could be fatal, apply the poison on Nate's skin. She had established the practice of dabbing him with the oil over the last two nights, this time with a bamboo stick applicator. The aconitine would slowly flood his system and kill him hours later, long after he returned home. Jen got to her feet, folded forward with her palms flat on the floor, and exhaled. She straightened and walked to the bedroom to take a shower before bed, snapping lights off as she walked through the apartment. She lighted a sandalwood taper and took her shower by candlelight. The woody fragrance of sandalwood was a nice change from the ylang ylang oil, which hung heavy everywhere without dissipating, like the copper stench of stale blood in a charnel house. Nearly midnight. It was a good thing that Benford and Nate were not going to hear what Dominica planned. There were no other options. They were going to kill Nate tomorrow night, and she didn't even have to think too hard about it. She was going to kill Zhenyao, the poison feathered bird, or try to anyway. Dominica stood in the darkened living room of her MSS guest flat, wondering if she would survive the next half hour. She wore black pajama pants and a black T-shirt over a sports bra that flattened her chest and hugged her ribs. She didn't want to be flopping around if she actually had to engage Zhen hand to hand. She wondered if the Russian Spetsnaz-derived Sistema fighting technique she had learned over the years would even come close to what she imagined a Chinese assassin's martial arts skill would be. She still had to try. Otherwise, Nate was dead. Dominica had no intention of standing toe-to-toe with Zhen. She likely had weapons hidden all over the apartment, not to mention bullets, arrows, darts, and daggers, all dipped in lethal compounds. Having seen her move via surveillance monitor, Dominica also knew that Zhen was strong, lithe, and flexible, and no doubt would be able to absorb a lot of punishment in a stand-up fight. Dominica, therefore, had to ambush her and instantly incapacitate her. It would be the only way she could win. And all this had to be done in an MSS-controlled building filled with surveillance cameras and dozens of security guards, who would respond instantly to the tumult of an all-out catfight. If Dominica could not take the Chinese girl out quickly and silently, the responding security guards additionally could power the surveillance equipment in the apartment back on, documenting for Gorelikov and Putin Dominica's efforts to save Nate. They would draw the same instant conclusion. Dominica was working for the Americans. She'd be arrested in Hong Kong, flown to Beijing for interrogation, bundled on to the interminable flight to Moscow, and then driven in a closed van directly from the tarmac to the gates of Butyrka prison, where more than interrogation would be waiting for her. That is, if Zhen Yao didn't kill her first. She knew she couldn't simply walk out of her apartment door tonight. It certainly was connected to an alarm. Go down one floor and gaily knock on Zhen's door, also probably alarmed, to invite herself in for a late-night cap. She had scoped out her balcony, and that of Zhen's apartment directly below. She thought she could climb over her balcony railing, lower herself as far as possible, and take a swinging drop down onto Zhen's balcony. If she mistimed her swing or if her hands slipped, nothing more would matter. They were 9 stories up. Dominica had searched her apartment for any possible weapons. The kitchen was not stocked, there were no chef's knives. She had found a small toolbox in the utility closet from which she took a box cutter with a retractable blade and a medium-weight claw hammer. Both these potential weapons were close-range and inefficient, but that's all she had. She retracted the blade, tucked the box cutter into her bra, and stuck the handle of the hammer into her waistband. Time to go poison bird hunting. She remembered to unlock her apartment door from the inside so she could get back in after she settled with Zhen. The Grenville House building was totally dark. Dominica was relieved to find that by hanging by her fingers she could actually touch the lower balcony railing with her toes, and was able to drop quietly onto the dark balcony of Zhen's apartment. The balcony door was open and she tiptoed in, passing into a wall of ylang-ylang fragrance. The sound of shower water came from the bedroom, and Dominica reached for the hammer as she moved forward in the dark. No hammer. She had not heard it slip out of her pajama bottoms or hit the driveway 9 stories down. Dominica peeked into the bathroom. Flickering candlelight was barely enough to see through the fogged glass partition of the big walk-in shower. Zhen stood with her back to Dominica beneath the rectangular rain shower head, luxuriating under the soft deluge, arms above her head, muscles in her buttocks bunching as she moved, wet hair slick on her skull. Dominica tried to remember the locations of the major veins and arteries in the human body, knowing the box-cutter blade was only an inch long. "Get on with it," she told herself, "before you start moaning like a cow." A wave of rage boiled in Dominica's gut for what she was about to do, for what they were forcing her to do. She measured the distance through the opening of the glass, and felt for the box-cutter, thinking, "Slash, don't stab, slash at throat, eyes, neck." Just before she stepped forward, her eye caught a kimono hanging on a wall peg, and she left the box-cutter alone, reached over, and drew the silk belt free, then quickly twisted 2 loops into a constricting slipknot, stepped into the shower, and slipped the loop over Zhen's head, pulling the knot tight. Moving faster than humanly possible, Zhen turned to face her and tried to bow her head to slip the loop, but Dominica stepped outside the glass, drew the belt over the top edge, and pulled the belt down with all her might, adding her body weight, yanking Zhen's cheek sideways against the inside of the glass with a clunk and with another pull off her feet. The glass kept Zhen's hands and feet away from her. Zhen's toes drummed against the shower wall, her breasts, brown nipples, and pubic delta flattened against the wet glass, her fingers scrabbling at the material around her throat, but the soaked silk had tightened into an impossible knot, the loop pulling her head ear high, and she shook like a fish, side to side, and tried to push off the glass with her feet, her thighs flexing. Rasping grunts came out of her open mouth, but the noise of the shower covered the sound. After 3 minutes of violent thrashing as the oxygen in her brain was used up, her kicking slowed, and her hands fell away from her throat, and she quivered for another 3 minutes, head canted sideways, spittle drizzling out of the corner of her mouth. Rivulets of water ran down the glass as Zhen stared through it, dead-eyed and open-mouthed, at Dominica, who had sat down on the bathroom floor with a thump, feet braced, holding the belt, her arms screaming, staring back at the wet corpse. 5 minutes, 10, an hour later, Dominica couldn't tell. She made her cramping hands let go, and Zhen slid down the partition, her pancake breasts squeezing on the wet glass, normally a bawdy and erotic sound during shower sex, but now it was ugly and final. Zhen flopped on her back, chin up, legs splayed, the shower water filling her mouth and dribbling down either cheek. Dominica turned off the water. The tock-tock sound of the dripping drain beneath the body was her only requiem. Frantically drying her feet and legs, Dominica moved fast through the living room. No more chakras to palpitate with vibrating gongs here. Opened the front door, ignoring the possibility of a silent alarm, and left it ajar, got into the stairwell, and pulled the handle of the fire alarm box she had marked the day before. Now she wanted noise and confusion. The peculiar Hong Kong fire alarm was a whoop-whoop siren that brought tenants out into the hallways as Dominica ran up one flight to her apartment door, pushed it open, and quickly put on a robe, then stood in the corridor looking uncertain and frightened. Rainy Sheng Huan came running down the corridor in a hoisin-stained sleeveless undershirt and boxer shorts, and he protectively bustled her down 9 floors in a stairwell crowded with yelling residents, crying children, and a squawking cockatoo in a bamboo cage. Dominica was booked into a luxury hotel suite in Kowloon that night, her clothes, toiletries, and belongings packed up and delivered to her the next morning. A shaken and embarrassed Rainey told her that fire investigators responding to the alarm had found Zhen Gao, murdered, in the operational apartment, strangled in the shower. The MSS were convinced that a CIA action team had killed her, likely they had rappelled from the roof, and that the American Nash had probably assisted. There were other theories, as they cast wildly for explanations.
"No single person could have caught Zhen Yao off guard and bested her in combat," said Rainey. "There's no other explanation."
"It could not have been a random crime? Rape? Robbery?" asked Dominica.
Rainey shook his head. "Impossible. She could have thrown a petty thief over the balcony railing with one arm."
"An unfortunate and frustrating conclusion to this operation," said Dominica. "What will you do now?"
Rainey wanted to regain some face in light of this debacle.
"The Gui Lo, the foreign devil Nash, is in Hong Kong temporarily, without diplomatic immunity. Beijing has instructed me to direct the Hong Kong police to arrest Nash on suspicion of murder. He will be remanded to Stanley Prison until his trial and sentencing, then sent to Lo Gai, a work camp in western China where he will learn to dig coal in the mines. That is, if something worse does not happen to him while he is in custody."
This was a whole new danger. If Nate was arrested and jailed, the MSS wouldn't have to assassinate him. They would stage a dramatic show trial with international coverage. He would die in a prison camp on the windswept steppes of western China. He had to get out of Hong Kong immediately. But would the station learn about Grace's death and the arrest warrant in time? Or would Nate blithely appear at her apartment tonight with a bouquet of flowers? Bosh, God, he could walk right into their arms. Dominica fought her panic. Would she have to barge into the U.S. consulate to deliver a warning? She daydreamed about it. The end of her career as a spy and the start of a life together with Nate. It was a warm daydream. He would be astonished to see her in Hong Kong halfway around the globe. She imagined their first kiss in the lobby of the consulate, not caring who saw them. Snap out of it. But the MSS made up her mind for her. A female escort stayed in the hotel room with her for the evening, and the next morning Dominica was driven to the airport by a dyspeptic Rainey Shanghuan and put on a direct Air China flight to Moscow with no further courtesy calls in Beijing, proposed or offered. It wasn't exactly a snub. The Chinese were agitated and bewildered. The MSS General Sun and the Minister of State Security, moreover, were mortified over their operational failure, witnessed firsthand and up close by a Russian intelligence officer. The loss of face was too great for her to be received as a guest at the ministry. What would they think if they learned that their exalted guest from a fraternal service was the one who had throttled their highly trained executioner? Now it was a race against time. Would the Americans learn about the warrant before Nate was rounded up by the Hong Kong police? She wouldn't know until tomorrow. The flight would take 10 hours. She'd read the SVR Asia reports in the morning. Nate was on his own. As it turned out, Dominica needn't have worried. A cooperative young lieutenant in the Hong Kong police who received an envelope every month for confidential chats with Bunty Boothby, passed the news about the murder and the arrest warrant. The ASIS officer requested an urgent meeting with Nate and COS Burns. They all were seriously shaken to learn that gorgeous Grace Gao was an MSS bird dog. Nate was utterly gobsmacked when Bunty's agent added that Grace had been part of an MSS operation to suborn Nate and elicit the name of their new PLA recruitment. A close call, but who had killed her? COS Burns paced in the 5 feet of his cubicle office.
"Right now it doesn't matter who whacked her. We'll find out sooner or later," he said. He pointed at Nate. "You just avoided the little bighorn." Nate put his head in his hands.
"The university and the restaurant, I should have seen it," he said almost to himself. "I was too focused on signing her up."
"You did nothing wrong," said Burns. "By the book. I read and released all your cables and contact reports."
"These things happen, mate," said Bunty solicitously, one leg hooked over the arm of the couch in Burns's office. "Tell me at least she gave you a gobby."
Nate couldn't leave Hong Kong or Macau by air, for both airports were being watched closely. There were no cruise ships in harbor. Bunty floated the idea that Nate could just possibly take a train from Hong Kong Hung Hom Station to Guangzhou's East Station and catch a flight to Seoul or Tokyo from there. He thought the MSS would never expect such a bold maneuver. That option would require Nate to wait for an unspecified amount of time for an alias passport from Langley, which was problematic. He couldn't hide indefinitely in the consulate, too many locals. Finally, the risk of Nate actually traveling into China to get out of China convinced COS Burns that the option was not viable. CIA headquarters, meanwhile, was flooding Hong Kong Station with interrogatory cables about the developmental case against Grace, her murder, the continued security of the new asset Songbird, and proposals for smuggling Nate out of Hong Kong. Benford personally spoke to Nate on the secure phone and seemed calm and mild. "Your performance with Songbird and with this woman was exemplary," said Benford. "Keep me appraised of your exfil plans, and get back here as quickly as possible." He hung up before Nate could reply, but from Benford this was a love letter. That was something, at least. A day later, COS had a plan. They borrowed a uniform from the curious but cooperative assistant military attaché, a commander in the U.S. Navy. The tech officer in the station matched the color of Nate's hair in a modified lip-brow mustache, and gave him slightly longer sideburns and heavy tortoiseshell eyeglasses to round out his face. The next evening, humid and overcast, Commander Nash boarded a bus from the motor pool with 20 consulate employees, a majority of whom were from the station. The bus drove down Connaught Road, through the tunnel under the harbor, and pulled up to the municipal pier on Canton Road in Kowloon for a public ship visit on the USS Blue Ridge, a 600-foot amphibious command ship and the flagship of the U.S. Navy's 7th Fleet, making her biannual amicable port call. As they arrived, Bunty Boothby and Marigold Doherty were hectoring Hong Kong police on duty at the foot of the gangplank to be let aboard without invitations. Marigold was in a long dress and heels, yelling at Bunty for forgetting the invitations at home, calling him a nong and breaking into tears. The busload of consulate employees arrived, and the overwhelmed police privates hurriedly did a head count and let everyone on board. They didn't blink at Nate in all the confusion. Bunty toasted Nate in the wardroom, thanked him for being a mate, and noted that Beijing would be mad as a cut snake when they eventually realized that Nathaniel Nash was out of China. At the end of the evening, a young petty officer switched places with Nate and got off the ship, while Nate stayed aboard, out of sight. The Blue Ridge departed Hong Kong the next morning and returned to fleet headquarters in Yokosuka, Japan, in 3 days, a transit of 1,500 nautical miles, during which time Nate stayed in his cabin, ate alone in the officer's mess, and watched half a dozen movies. He brooded about Grace. He wondered about Dominica and the mole hunt, the briefing for the DCIA candidates, and his standing with Benford and Forsyth, and waited in uneasy anticipation of what they had in mind for him next. Overseas assignment, secondment to FBI, a tiny cubicle in the basement of headquarters. He didn't know why, but he had a feeling, he just knew, that he would see Dominica very soon. Zhenyao's Shanghai, lettuce soup. Saute diced white onions and minced garlic in butter in a soup pot, stirring until softened. Add chopped coriander, salt, and pepper. Add peeled, cubed potatoes, whole lettuce leaves, do not trim the ribs, and water to cover. Bring to a boil, then cover and simmer until potatoes are soft. Puree liquid to a velvety texture, whisk in butter, and season to taste. Serve hot or at room temperature. Chapter 31. League of Nations.
"You're as bad as Angleton," said Acting Director Farrell to Benford, who was standing in front of the spotless desk in the DCIA's office on the 7th floor of headquarters. Unsullied by cables, memos, or ops plans, the director's workspace contrasted wildly with Benford's desk 3 floors down in CID, which more closely resembled downtown Tokyo after Godzilla walked through. "You counterintelligence fanatics waste time chasing shadows that don't exist." Angleton had been the zealous messianic CI chief in the 70s who saw Soviet disinformation and provocation under every rock. Benford shifted his feet slightly. Farrell was a lank-haired economics analyst from the Directorate of Intelligence who was in the eyes of the jaundiced workforce in Langley an unlikely pick to run the agency, even temporarily. He had dishwater eyes, a waxen complexion, a reedy cartoon voice, and an abiding, singular interest in promoting himself. Farrell had first been noticed by POTUS as a fellow internationalist with a healthy dislike of CIA cowboys. Farrell had further endeared himself to the White House after publicly declaring he would credit the assessments of headquarters-based analysts regarding the political situation in any given country rather than rely on the estimations of the chief of station on the ground, an apostasy increasingly in vogue after the drowning of DCIA Alex Larson. As Farrell's comment became common knowledge, operations officers in the foreign field continued their work, silently toasting the acting director at recruitment dinners worldwide. "This mole is hardly a shadow," said Benford, controlling the impulse to tell this ponderous bureaucrat he was a preening cockatoo. "His existence has been corroborated by a sensitive asset in Moscow." The director snorted. "It's always the same," Farrell said. "Sensitive asset says something, and we go off on a wild goose chase. It's absurd." "What asset reported this?" The director had the right to ask about any source, including true name, but Benford protected his restricted handling cases jealously, usually referring to them only by cryptonyms. "Diva. Our top source in Russia, her intelligence has been impeccable. She's stolen secrets from inside the Kremlin itself." Farrell made a face. "I prefer to avoid that hackneyed phrase, steal secrets. Stealing implies extra legal and morally reprehensible methods." "It's the definition of espionage since Judas kissed Jesus," said Benford. "What do you call it?" Farrell looked up, nettled at his tone. The two men glared at each other. "We don't steal secrets," he said. Benford kept a straight face. "I've heard that homily before somewhere. It's as imbecilic now as it was then." Farrell swiveled in his chair, turning his back on Benford. "I didn't call you up here to listen to your old line retrogressive cant. I called you because I understand you were not fully briefing the 3 nominees for the directorship. You are to brief them all unreservedly with no evasion, including the reporting from this star asset of yours. Do you understand? Full briefings. This asset is in a precarious position. The intelligence can be sourced directly to her," said Benford, already knowing what he was going to do. "Stop this pedantry," snapped Farrell. "The nominees all have top secret clearances. Brief them. Everything. Am I clear?" "You're going to get your ass fired, Simon," said Forsythe. They were sitting in Benford's office. Lucius Westfall was squeezed on the couch trying to keep a teetering stack of files from falling on him and onto the floor. "We suspect that one of the candidates for the next director of the Central Intelligence Agency is a mole run by Moscow Center, the Kremlin's candidate. If Magnet is selected as DCIA, the agency will cease to exist, and the United States will be blind to overseas threats. It will be worse than Philby, worse than Ames or Hansen."
"We'd have to exfil and resettle hundreds of assets," said Forsythe. "Not just the Russians, but sources in China, North Korea, and Cuba. The cereal aisle at the supermarket in Alexandria is going to look like the League of Nations with all the ex-agents grocery shopping," said Westfall, who once babysat for a Chinese defector and knew how impossible most defectors could be. Those will be the ones we agree to settle. There'll be a lot of low-level Joes left behind who'll be tossed in jail or retired without pension, said Forsythe.
You're both forgetting the ones who won't leave and will try to gut it out, said Benford. The ones they'll feed to the lions.
They were all thinking about Dominica. So you're willing to risk your career to defy the director? And trade for Diva? What would you do?
They all knew the answer to the question, including the greenhorn on the couch, who already felt fiercely protective of the blue-eyed Russian.
Time for a barium enema, said Benford. Lucius, I'll need your help. Westfall's eyes widened. He frantically wondered whether this could possibly be a medieval secret rite of initiation in the operations directorate or, as plausibly, an unsavory personal practice of Benford's in which he, as factotum, was somehow expected to assist. He was sure it had not been listed as one of his professional duties. Westfall was immeasurably relieved, though alarmed, at the scope of the sedition, when Forsythe and Benford explained what barium enema meant, a counterintelligence test, and what they wanted. Just then, Benford's secretary walked in with lunch, a cardboard box with styrofoam cups of egg drop soup from the cafeteria, which had become popular with the recruitment of Songbird. She handed around cups as the room grew silent, except for the sound of Benford slurping. They were fortunate that for the next round of briefings, each nominee had scheduling conflicts, so individual sessions had to be scheduled at different times. Benford obsequiously briefed Senator Feigenbaum and her scowling altar boy Farbison on a sensitive operation to recruit a Russian code clerk in Buenos Aires, based not only on demonstrated vulnerability or regulatory transgression, but simply because the young bachelor was observed to be lonely. Farbison snorted in derision and the senator muttered fishing expedition under her breath, neither of them acknowledging the immense value of recruiting a code clerk. In reality, Benford had concocted the entire operation. If Feigenbaum Farbison were the moles, the senator would quickly recall the blameless code clerk to Moscow, something the cooperative Argentine service immediately could ascertain to get him out of the crosshairs of perfidious CIA. Benford wasted an hour play-acting trying to convince these two congressional bivalves that the operation had merit. By then, time was up, and Benford had avoided briefing his most sensitive cases for today. It was a dodge that would work only once. The next day, Forsythe briefed Vice Admiral Roland. Benford had suggested that Forsythe turn on a little of his salt-and-pepper charm to see if the Dürr three-striper would react to him. Forsythe later grumpily reported that mildly flirting with the Admiral was like throwing cotton balls at riveted steel plate.
"Christ," said Forsythe. "I wore my dark suit with the Italian pocket square, threw her the case officer smile, turned on the charm, and complimented her on her inspired management of ONR. I let her catch me looking at her legs. I told her a story about my fiancé who was lost at sea during a typhoon. Nothing. No reaction. I've had North Koreans at diplomatic receptions react more than she did. I went home that night and cried into my pillow."
"Age is the great leveler. It catches up with us all," intoned Benford, commiserating. "Though it may have been the pocket square." Forsythe had briefed the Admiral on a troubling case in Panama City involving a recruited but obstreperous senator in the Panamanian parliament who had befriended an unidentified and imaginary Russian diplomat who was talking out of school. The senator had refused to identify the Russian until the station agreed to raise his salary. Benford knew that even the possibility of an unknown Russian dip getting cozy with an access agent from CIA would result in a hasty Russian approach to the venal senator in an attempt to identify the wayward diplomat. The senator, in fact, was a long-time and loyal asset who would report any inveigling contact or surveillance on him. "The Admiral listened politely but was clearly not interested," said Forsythe.
"Probably thinking about magnetic impedance in jewels," said Benford.
"She continues to be the least likely of the three, in my view." He turned to Westfall. "You will brief Ambassador Vano tomorrow. He seems less concerned with rank and is equable in nature, so he presumably will not object to a briefing from a junior snail. Play it with youthful enthusiasm and make it appear you're exceeding your brief. Observe his reaction. He is a successful businessman with access who is vain and inexperienced in intelligence matters. Play on that. For a junior analyst who was new to the operations directorate, Lucius played his role with a fine hand as the over-serious analyst with facts and figures who liked to hear himself talk. He told the ambassador about a fictitious Russian naval captain in the Northern Fleet stationed in Murmansk, who intended to defect and smuggle himself and his family into Finland in the back of one of the hundreds of 18-wheelers passing through the Valiman Rajani Litispaika, the southernmost Finnish border crossing on the E-18. Westfall bragged that the Russian captain commanded a fleet ballistic submarine, would potentially bring kilos of top-secret naval documents out with him, and would attempt the crossing in 2 months. This would be irresistible bait for the Russians, who would tear apart every truck exiting the Federation, causing holy chaos at the border, which would be easily observed. Benford was enthused now that he had spread his trail of breadcrumbs at the feet of each candidate. I anticipate FSB and SVR will collaborate and that DIVA will be involved in the investigations, Benford said. We, therefore, will have positive intelligence on which variant was reported to Moscow. If we ever get a reliable commo, grumbled Forsyth. We cannot keep meeting her on the street. Hersey tells me a new piece of communications gear has been tested and will soon be ready for deployment. He is coming to demonstrate it this afternoon. You should all be here to assess its suitability for DIVA, especially Nash, when he returns from the Orient. Nash returned the next day, was sarcastically congratulated by Benford on having resisted using his phallus in the Hong Kong operations, and was briefed on the mole hunt. Hersey came to Benford's office and nodded to the officers in the room. Definitely channeling Gary Cooper, thought Nate, noticing his tall man's habit of instinctively ducking slightly under the doorframe. Hersey wore a soft sports jacket over a pinstripe shirt with khaki trousers and was carrying a silver Zero Halliburton attaché case. Behind him, dragging a large black plastic Pelican footlocker, was another tech introduced as Frank Mendelson, who was short, slight, dark, shy, and twitchy, about whom Benford whispered, "The guy you don't want assembling the bomb in the basement." Hersey nodded to Nate. The ops officers had worked with Hersey before. He'd broken into a German factory with Gable to sabotage centrifuge parts destined for Iran, and he had trained Nate's friend Hannah Archer before she was assigned to Moscow. Hersey was what they called an operational tech, a trained engineer who knew you couldn't sneak a listening device into an office if it came in 12 pieces and weighed 600 pounds. He understood operations, and his technical solutions reflected that understanding, a rare bird. As he did typically, Benford had bypassed the orotund director of OTS and confidentially asked Hersey to consider solutions to DIVA's communication problem now that she was to be director of SVR. He asked the rangy tech to think out of the box and come up with an answer. It was a little risky for Hersey to accept and work on a bootleg project for Benford without his own chief's knowledge, but he couldn't abide his boss, a non-technical outsider whom he called a seagull manager. Swoops in, starts screaming, shits on everything, then flies away, Hersey had told Benford. Hersey sat on the couch, his knees coming even with his stomach. I assume it's okay to talk details in front of everyone, he said. Benford nodded. I had the beginning of an idea, so I asked NGA, that's the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, the people who fly the satellites, to image SVR headquarters in Yasenevo. They did an ELINT shot, which reads electronic emissions. Then the next pass was a MASINT shot, which measures energy. I was looking for two things, that the main buildings radiate electric energy to the outside, and that there is only one main transformer. Step-down transformers block energy in a separate power plant. How'd you do? Said Forsyth. 2 out of 2, said Hersey. The buildings radiate, so there must be miles of wiring inside the walls, and the transformers are in a dedicated power plant on the other side of the compound. My pulse is racing, but what exactly are you telling us? Said Benford. Hersey smiled. You're going to like this, Simon. The Russians hardened their headquarters on the inside against external eavesdropping, but didn't think about energy leaking through the wires outside to the surrounding pine forest. The bottom line is that the two main buildings of SVR headquarters in Moscow are, in essence, a big honking antenna, he said. Even the shapes of the two buildings, a 15-floor tower connected to a 5-floor wing shaped like a Y, act like a Yagi directional antenna. I will not ask what a Yagi antenna is, but how does that help us, said Benford. That's Yagi, and it's just what we need. Hersey turned to Mendelssohn, who opened the locker and took out a sleek desk lamp, composed of a large ebony base, a stainless steel L-shaped arm, and a broad black shade. Hersey smiled and put the lamp on the arm of the couch. Stick this lamp on your agent's desk and plug it into the wall. That's it. She can dictate, record, or type messages to Simon through this lamp, using the building's electrical wires as a carrier, even with people present in the agent's office, said Hersey. Another feature, align documents along the base under the shade and you can photograph them, even while signing them, right in front of a secretary looking over your shoulder, and the lamp will tell her when an incoming message from Simon is waiting for her. How's it do that? Said Nate. An air vortex ring, said Hersey. What does that mean? Said Forsythe. It'll blow in her ear, said Hersey. That can't be a bad thing, said Westfall. Hersey left after 2 hours, having demonstrated the functions of the desk lamp concealment for Diva's covert communications equipment. Hersey told them the system was encrypted Bolero, which Crypt Simon found fatuous. Nevertheless, he was pleased. Hersey had outdone himself, supported by the engineering brilliance of Frank Mendelssohn, whose nickname in the office inexplicably was Money Shot. The Bolero transmitter receiver was interactive, multifunctional, and protected from tampering by a retinal scan permissive action link. Messages or images that Dominica loaded into the device would be stored until it detected the authentication code from the BattleFat telemetry satellite in geosynchronous orbit above the Arctic Circle. In 3.5 seconds, Dominica's stored messages would flood through the building's electrical grid to the satellite, and simultaneous incoming messages would be read by the Bolero lamp at the other end of the wall plug in Diva's office. Will these transmissions be detectable inside the building? Nate asked. Is it safe? SVR ComSec experts solved that problem for us, said Hersey. They shielded the building against external eavesdropping so our communications don't emanate inside. We got lucky. I have a question, said Westfall, ever the analyst. I understand that transmissions to satellites are vulnerable to radio intercept or direction finding. You mean triangulation, said Hersey. Not with this system. The power is low, like with your SRAC equipment, but, more important, transmissions are diffused. It's the difference between tracing back a beam in the night sky to find the searchlight and stuffing fog into a gunny sack. Benford grunted approvingly at that, a metaphor he could understand. Frank Mendelssohn then had explained principles of haptic, tactile communication, organic user interface, and flexible display with bending interactions until Benford began going purple in the face. The not insignificant consideration of getting the desk lamp into SVR headquarters without arousing suspicion appeared to be a problem, until Nate said Dominica could carry it in herself as she moved into the director's office and chose new furnishings. The lamp would be cached to her by Moscow station. Risky, but doable. And once the lamp was on her desk, she needn't step foot on the street to meet a case officer. Personal meets would be reserved for when Diva traveled outside Russia. Benford said they should deploy Bolero as soon as possible. Diva would once more be online, and Benford could begin reading other gentlemen's mail again, with the exception of the messages to and from Magnet. And that was the problem. CIA's Egg Drop Soup. Heat chicken stock and use a little to mix with cornstarch into a slurry. In the remaining stock, add ginger, soy sauce, diced scallions, thin-sliced mushrooms, white pepper, and bring to a boil. Add cornstarch slurry, stir well, and simmer. Beat eggs vigorously in a separate bowl and slowly pour them into the soup while stirring the stock, so that the eggs cook and spread out in ribbons. An optional ingredient is kernel or creamed corn. Garnish with additional chopped scallions and serve immediately. Chapter 32. Snaggletooth. Dominica's return from China, rumors of her secret commission to Beijing had the Siloviki, except Gorelikov and FSB Chief Bortnikov, frantic with envy and trepidation, coincided with the announcement of her promotion to one-star general and to the post of director of the SVR. Chubby, jowly faces clustered around her after the Security Council meeting to congratulate her, enveloping her in an impossibly cloying miasma of competing colognes underlaid with the earthy, fierce sweat of officials who had millions squirreled away in overseas accounts. It, therefore, was important to establish good relations with this Shliuka, this former trollop, who now had the organizational means and authorities to investigate foreign bank accounts whenever Vladimir Vladimirovich ordered it. Beefsteak hands with manicured nails and pinky rings pumped her hand and yellow halos quivered above their yellow smiles, interspersed by the rare blue crowns of the few pragmatic thinkers on the council, the occasional gazelles who roamed among the muddy-flanked buffaloes. The thinkers had a low survival rate in the jungles of the Kremlin. The official promotion ceremony took place the following week in the gilded Andreevsky Hall in the Grand Kremlin Palace, in front of the 40-foot curved gold filigreed doors above which the black double-headed eagle of the Russian Federation stood guard, wings outspread, the orb and scepter in its talons. The relics represented God's dominion over the earth and the monarch's benevolent and just rule over his people. Dominica contemplated the towering irony of benevolence and justice in modern Russia as the president approached her to pin the Order of Merit to the Fatherland first class on the lapel of her forest green tunic, the military uniform the service chiefs wore to ceremonial events to reflect their flag ranks. Dominica hated the baggy cut of the double-breasted jacket, the stiff epaulets, and the straight-line green skirt more suitable for a librarian or a wedding magistrate's clerk. The clunky black service shoes she couldn't even look at.
Pozdravliayu, General, said Putin, looking into her eyes.
Felicitations. His fingers lingered while pinning the medal on her lapel, solicitously smoothing the hanging claret ribbon, brushing with knowing fingers the start of the swell of her left breast. Dominica idly wondered if there was an ornate general's belt buckle to be awarded next. That would present additional opportunity for the president to smooth the folds of her uniform skirt.
"Thank you, Mr. President. I will continue to serve the Rodina with all my energies," said Dominica, standing at what she imagined was a semblance of attention.
Putin's azure halo pulsed once, and he gave her an olive oil smile that unambiguously transmitted, "No, serve me with all your energies, stuff the Rodina," as he shook her hand and stepped sideways to the other medal recipient, a 27-year-old champion rhythmic gymnast who was retiring from the sport and had been named as a district organizer for Yedinaya Rossiya, the United Russia Party, the government's party that controlled 75% of parliamentary seats. Dominica wondered how she had qualified for that position. The president turned back to Dominica after laboriously pinning a sports medal on the blushing gymnast.
"I look forward to hosting you at the reception at the Cape in several days," said Putin, leering.
Dominica wondered if her dacha was wired for sound and video, and if the president had a key to the front door. Stupid questions.
"I will be there, Mr. President. Thank you for the invitation. And I must thank you again for the use of the dacha. It's quite beautiful."
Putin nodded. "The view of the sea from that particular dacha is second only to the view from the master apartment in the main house," he said, as if he were selling shares in a Ponzi scheme. Dominica smiled. "I have no doubt of that," she said, noncommittally. She was not going to stick out her chest, wet her lips, and tell him she couldn't wait to compare the two views. How to keep a suspicious, covetous, and randy despot's hands off you for 2 or 3 days without incurring his wrath or, worse, embarrassing him regarding performance issues. There were bawdy rumors on the streets of Moscow that Dmitry Medvedev, Putin's diminutive prime minister, a protege who had switched leadership positions with Putin as a way to satisfy term limits laws,
was better endowed and, well, more feral than his supposedly uber-virile patron. Medvedev's nickname from those years was Nano-President, but the mere thought that Putin was not the rampant alpha wolf among the whole pack could not be remotely contemplated.
"Until then," said the president before moving off. She felt footsteps coming up behind her.
"Congratulations, Director," said a smiling, jubilant Gorelikov with a flourish. "You've earned this honor, and we will accomplish great things in the coming months."
Great things, to be sure, thought Dominika, disrupting democracies, suborning innocents, enabling cloven-footed surrogates, maybe start the next world war. But Anton was reveling in the possibilities now that his ingenue, his creation, had landed the big job. "With the announcement of your new position, I took the liberty of transferring your belongings to your new penthouse on Kutuzovsky Prospect. You find it elegant and quite comfortable." How kind and thoughtful. The courteous favor was an opportunity for Gorelikov's team to rummage through her belongings. Bosh, thank God I buried my broken track equipment before I left. "The penthouse belonged to Andropov before he became first secretary," beamed Anton. "Charming. I hope they've taken out the hospital bed and oxygen tank since then."
"Your daily schedule will naturally be taken up with more representational duties, starting tomorrow evening with a formal diplomatic reception in the Georgievsky Hall here in the Grand Kremlin Palace. Besides the embassies, there will be various delegations."
Dominika's irrational first thought was that she had no dress for a formal reception. Gorelikov was a warlock, reading her mind. "Dominika, I also took the quite outrageous liberty of putting a selection of evening dresses in your closet," said Anton like a valet. "But I must apologize in advance for my utter lack of style. I hope at least one of them will suit." The elegant Gorelikov dressed today in an exquisite gray flannel suit of British cut, a white spread collar shirt, and a black knit tie would have chosen, Dominika had no doubt, elegant, expensive frocks in her exact size. "Welcome to the club," thought Dominika. "Now they're dressing you like a doll."
"I am sure they will be quite lovely, thank you," said Dominika, her mind drifting. She knew Benford would hear about her long-anticipated promotion within a day. TASS and Pravda would carry the announcement, doubtless highlighting the fact that General Dominika Igorova was one of the highest-ranked women in the government.
Modern Russia making great strides, thought Dominika, despite the unavoidable fact that the entire country was nothing more than a big petrol station with nuclear weapons and heaps of murdered dissidents. The crowd made no move to disperse. No one arrived at a state function after the president, and likewise no one departed before him. So Dominika continued speaking with Gorelikov, and they were soon joined by a mild and complimentary Alexander Bortnikov of the FSB, in a gorgeous powder-blue uniform with gold braid at lapels and cuffs. Bortnikov was a lieutenant general with 3 stars, after all. He shook hands with Dominika as he congratulated her, and his politely firm grip was dry and warm, his steady blue halo, matched by the equally steady aura above Gorelikov's head and shoulders, hinted at reserve and good sense. Perhaps she could eventually count these two as true allies in this Kremlin maze. Then she remembered that this beneficent and reasonable grandfather had planned and authorized Litvinenko's assassination in London. No one, but no one, was an ally. Sidelong glances from the milling Siloviki were ill-disguised. Nervous noses already had sniffed the air and tentatively identified a newly formed triumvirate, Gorelikov and the directors of SVR and FSB, a potent cabal favored by the president himself. But Dominika remembered Benford's warning when the subject of her becoming head of SVR first was raised. "You'll be close to the top, but even as you become indispensable to Vladimir, so will you be considered a threat to his suzerainty." Nate had to translate that word, but she knew he was right. From now on, her official life would be plagued with hidden tests, sly traps, and constant assessments of her loyalty. She grimly told herself that gutting the Kremlin for Benford, Nate, and Forsyth would be trebly satisfying from now on, as long as she survived. The familiar heartache welled up in her breast. Where was Nate now? Would they let them see each other?
She would have to pick a plausible foreign trip, her first as director, to be able to meet with her CIA friends, and from now on, she would have to contend with hovering aides and ever-present security personnel. Dominica would be busy in the next weeks.